From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The check is in the mail, or at least it will be soon. President Bush signed off on a plan to give individual taxpayers up to $600 as early as May, plus another $300 per child if they meet income guidelines. This move comes on the heels of economy experts warning of a recession and a disappointing unemployment report in January. In fact, today, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told Congress that the country's economic outlook looks bleak. But for people who have to choose between buying groceries and paying the heating bill, the extra cash may give them short-term comfort, but no long-term security. In just a moment, we'll talk to two economists about what people are really going to have to deal with if things get tight. But first, we have Sandra Robertson, the executive director of Georgia Citizens Coalition on Hunger. That Atlanta-based organization works with low-wage earners and people who are transitioning off of public assistance. Sandra, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, you know, a lot of people think that work is the answer to poverty, but if so, why are there people who we call the working poor?
Well, because there are a lot of people working that aren't earning enough income to sustain a living wage situation. They're making $7, sometimes $7.50, $8 an hour, but that's not enough to take care of a family of two or three children. And so the reality is that families, many families are working every day. Many of them are working full time and even overtime and are still living below the poverty level.
Can you give me a specific example of something a family is going through now in terms of what folks are dealing with in this kind of economy?
Well, I have, through our organization, the Georgia Citizens Coalition on Hunger, we have a hunger hotline, and we get a number of working families that are struggling to make ends meet, and they come in looking for food assistance. We had one family that had four or five children, a grandmother and a mother. They were living in a car, working at temporary work jobs, but sleeping in their car at night because they could not afford a place to live, a permanent place to live. It is outrageous. And this was a family that was very conscientious about trying to get on their feet. And eventually we helped them to find a location for housing, and they were able to get additional work. But for several months, they were in this limbo, and they were really having a hard time and could not find the kind of assistance that they needed to sustain them during this time when they were en route of being in a place to live and trying to find work and all of those various conditions. We have other situations where families are living in shelters. Sometimes they have jobs, and they are still not able to find an apartment. Today, it's very challenging to get an apartment because you have to have a significant down payment most often, and you also have to have good credit. They do credit checks now, and unfortunately, a lot of low-income families have had difficulty with their credit situation, so they don't always have the highest credit scores. And so it makes it very challenging for families living on the edge.
When you think about what's going on today in terms of folks settling into the idea that there's going to be some tough times ahead, the government saying we're going to hand out some checks to people in the form of tax rebates or incentives to spend money, is that going to help the families you're talking about?
Well, it'll be a short-term spike in that individual family's situation. If it's a family of two adults, a man and a woman, you know, a married couple, they'll get $1,200, and $1,200 will be a significant spike in their income for a short period of time. And likewise, with individuals, they'll get $600. And I think any of us, if we had an extra $600 in our hands, would be a nice thing. And it would help us maybe through that month or the next, maybe even couple of months. But it's going to be very short term. And I think what we need is to have more long-term solutions to correcting the problems that our overall economy is facing. We need jobs, quality jobs that pay living wages. And this has been a long growing problem in our economy. And it needs to, we need to have our leaders, our public officials, both at the national level and local levels, begin to have serious dialogue about how we're going to have an infusion of quality jobs that help to sustain families, not part-time, temporary, low-wage jobs with no benefits, no health care, no time off, no vacation time. And that's what a lot of workers are facing today. And it's creating a lot of stress and a lot of economic crisis for families.
Well, Sandra, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Sandra Robertson, the executive director of the Georgia Citizens Coalition on Hunger. She spoke with us from the studios at Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. So what's the big picture? We're going to find out more from Bill Spriggs. He's a professor and economics chair at Howard University, plus Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank based in Washington, D.C. Chris, Bill, welcome.
Hi, Foray.
Hi.
So let me start with you, Chris. She's calling Sandra based on the challenges that her clients are facing, more and better jobs. From your perspective, what role does government have in creating those jobs?
Well, I think she touched on some things in the interview. She pointed out that this is just a short-term infusion of cash here, and it doesn't really solve any long-term problems. In fact, I think the stimulus bill signed into law by President Bush makes long-term problems worse. It increases the federal deficit, which means taxes are going to have to rise in the future to pay off that debt. The funny thing about this is economists always tell Americans that they need to save more money, they need to pay down their credit card debt, and yet the message from the government with a stimulus bill is to spend, go out and buy flat screen TVs or whatever the case is. My recommendation to Americans, particularly low-income Americans, is to save this extra money. This is a bonus they're going to get, $600 or $100, $1,200. Save it. Open a bank account if you don't have a bank account. Put it away for a rainy day, and don't do what the president is telling you to do.
When you think about that, Bill, how's that going to affect the economy if people just say, well, I'm going to put this check away, which sounds like good common sense on a lot of levels, but it's not what this is intended to do.
Well, I think in fairness, what is going on is that the president and the Republican Party didn't want to do the more logical things about extending unemployment insurance, shoring up the safety net that would particularly help these low-income families and a lot of middle-income workers about to lose their jobs. And so as a compromise, we ended up with these checks. What the economy is facing, you heard in the story, we have had a problem with not having before-tax wages go up. And during the last 7 years, in fact, median income for Americans has fallen. So Americans have run up tremendous debts. And so while it may appear to be counterintuitive, you have to say compared to what? If folks do save this away or use it to take down their debt, eventually they're going to have to do that. So this really still will allow for some stimulus, because compared to what would happen otherwise, households having to bring their balance sheets in order, this is going to help that process. Understand that with home prices falling at about a 6% rate, this means that if you own a $140,000 home, you're about to have $8,000 just get burned up from underneath you. So your debt-to-equity ratio, the amount that you owe worth what you are worth, is going to change dramatically, and families have to pull that in order. So they're going to save anyway, and anything we can do to still have money in their hands is going to help them out.
Chris, when you frame yourself, or Cato frames itself as libertarian, what's your ideal for how the government would deal with this big crisis? What does it mean to have a libertarian approach?
Well, on housing, for example, it seems to me that for many years the government has been pushing and pushing and subsidizing people, frankly, who only have marginal finances to buy homes, when in fact homes that they can't really afford, and frankly, they probably, folks like that should probably be renting. I think with low-income people that there's a lot of things the federal government can do from a market perspective, and I'll give you one example. The price of food in this country is higher than it should be because of government regulations and controls. The price of milk is higher because of government regulations. The price of sugar is two or three times higher than world levels, and that increases the price of everything from breakfast cereal and all kinds of other products. The ethanol subsidies are now pushing up the price of all kinds of crops, wheat and everything else. The prices are going up.
So you're,
this is
you're
all
arguing,
caused by government.
You're arguing. From your perspective, Bill, when you think of what kinds of programs really could help working poor Americans, what would you like to see happen?
Well, we've taken the first step. We've raised the minimum wage, and we need to do more to get the minimum wage back where it was historically, roughly half the average wage. And we have had 7 years where we've just let the minimum wage fall so that it is possible to be poor and working in the United States, something that would have been illegal in the United States up until 1973 or 74. The other thing we have to do is, yes, low-income households probably should have help with their rent, and we have dramatically cut the programs that assist low-income households in getting access to affordable rental housing. So those types of things, yes, we need to do, but the economy is sick, and the government has a responsibility to address it. We can't treat it like, we would here in D.C. when it snows. We can wait until March or May and have it melt. People get hurt in the interim.
All right. Well, thank you both for your perspectives.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Chris Edwards, Cato Institute's Director of Tax Policy Studies, and Bill Spriggs, a professor and economics chair at Howard University. They both joined us from our studios at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This month, we're taking a look at African-American images and power players in the film industry. But what is power? Who has it, and how do you keep it? With me are three folks who have exercised their might in Hollywood. Rob Hardy is a founder of Rainforest Films, a production and distribution company based in Atlanta. D'Angela Proctor-Steed is a co-founder of Momentum Entertainment, a distributor that also owns Strange Fruit Films. And Jeff Clanagan is the CEO of Code Black Entertainment. Hi, folks.
Hello.
How you doing?
Doing great. So, Rob, Rainforest is best known for last year's smash hit Stomp the Yard. Let's hear a little bit.
Are we doing a step show? Or are we doing a rap video?
It's a new day, man. I mean, I ain't signed on to be no loser. No,
losing is a state of mind.
But this frat has been living in that state for the last 7 years, man.
Only reason you're holding on to all that talk about tradition is because you cannot keep up with the present.
I make you bet. You go and you get your line brothers together. And I'll get my guys. And we'll throw down.
You're on.
Tomorrow night. At the Phoenix.
So far, the film has grossed $75 million in theaters. But, Rob, you've been working in this business for a while. You made Chocolate City for back in 1994. How did that experience of working in the industry in the 90s differ from what you're able to do today?
You know, I think that right now there's so many more opportunities that are open to people. When we were first starting out, myself and my partner, William Packer, we started at Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. So for us, the role models that we saw were the Spike Lees and the John Singletons and people of that ilk. And we thought, you know what, if you make a film, a Hollywood studio will pick it up. So when we shot our first film while we were students, we had a premiere and we thought that you'd have Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese flying to Tallahassee to see this great black motion picture. And that just didn't happen. And it was at that moment that we realized that the key was self-distribution for us. And it started for us releasing our film in Tallahassee. And then upon moving to Atlanta, when we did our next film called Toi, we used the same principles that we used on Chocolate City to distribute that film, and the success of that distribution theatrically got us our working relationship with the studio, which for us happened to be Sony Pictures.
So what are the good and bad parts about moving from a kind of, you know, a lot of folks talk about how books are distributed in Harlem. You know, it's like folks go around, try to get them out on a lot of corners with guys who can then pass them out and sell them on a very personal basis. It sounds like your distribution strategy in the past was really based on, okay, we know this market, we're going to market to it. And now you have this big studio that's your distribution partner. What are the pros and cons of going from one method to the other?
The pros of being independent is that you control your product from start to finish. You control how it's marketed, where it goes, how it plays, how it's seen and received. And then if it's a hit, you get a lot more money. You can make a whole lot more money being an independent than you can with the studio. The challenge is that you don't have the same access. You don't have the same marketing dollars to be able to promote your film, because now you have to think you're competing with the internet and umpteenth, you know, cable networks and channels, as well as big budget motion picture, all vying for the same attention of that one consumer. And having a studio on your side allows you to compete on that same level playing field to get that exposure. But the con to the studio side, obviously, is that the pay scale isn't the same if it's a hit. And also, you don't have the same level of control over the product itself, nor do you have that in how it's marketed and presented to the people.
So, D'Angela, you're here with me at NPR West, and I can see you nodding your head. In addition to the distribution issues, you have also taken on moving from one part of the industry to another. You've been very successful in doing these live music films with everyone, you know, from Seal to Babyface. What does it take for you to transition from that part of the film world into doing features?
Well, actually, we started in music. I'm an attorney by trade, and when I moved to Atlanta, to do in the entertainment business, we started a production company primarily to produce music videos. And we worked with everyone from 3-6 Mafia to Nas to we did commercials for TLC. We've worked with, you know, a lot of the Outkast and different artists like that. So we started in music, and then during the first year of business, we produced our first feature film, which was Book of Love. And we sold it to our model is it's similar to Rob and Will's model in that we started off making independent feature films, and then we went to the studios and thought that they were going to buy them for, you know, millions of dollars, and, you know, was going to have a parade or something. But but we were successful at selling our movies to studios, and we're actually in business with studios. And the music concert series that you're referring to, we've actually done those things while being out here in the film business.
So what are you moving into now? You have Momentum Entertainment. What are you guys up to?
Well, Momentum is now in the process of closing out a raise to independently finance our own slate of pictures. And that's because Momentum was created as an alternative distribution platform to address some of the concerns that Rob was talking about with when your film, you know, is an independent film is made and there's no distribution because the studios aren't interested. So we feel like there's a whole slew of films that may not deserve a wide theatrical release, but shouldn't go straight to DVD. So Momentum was created to fill that gap. But we did Seat Filler as our first film through that model, and we did it very successfully. But we weren't
That's
able
Kelly to... Kelly Rowland.
Yeah, the Kelly Rowland and Dwayne Martin film. We weren't able to find an acquisition that really held up, that would hold up into that model. So now we're in the process of creating a fund so that we can actually finance the films. Now that we've mastered making films, we've mastered marketing them, we've mastered just self-distributing them, so now we're going to put them all together. And that's what Momentum is doing. And simultaneously, Strange Fruit is in the television business. We produced Exalted, the docuseries for BET, which is a docuseries on ministers that aired in the fall. And on Easter Sunday, our show Family Reunion will premiere on TV One. So we're doing a lot of good things.
Well, Jeff, let me turn to you. You're producing the film version of the hit musical Mama, I Wanna Sing with Patti LaBelle and Ciara. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Yes. open up your eyes.
So, Jeff, how did you make this project happen?
Well, I made the project happen. I'd been a fan of the play since the 80s. Just as a background, I actually used to be a concert promoter, so I was very familiar with the play, you know, when it toured in the 80s and 90s, and I had promoted a number of gospel plays myself. So this was a property that I was a big fan of. And I had been actually chasing the property. It took me about 3 or 4 years to actually get the rights, but with the success of Bishop T.D. Jakes' movies and Tyler Perry, you know, the market was just right for Mama I Want to Sing. So when I was able to acquire the property, I just took it into Fox and entered to a production deal with Fox to produce the movie.
And specifically Fox Faith, a subdivision of the...
That is correct.
What does it mean to you to, you know, all of you seem to be very aware of what it means to find the right marketing angle. What is it like to you know, go in and say, okay, well, our product is good for you because of blank, and how does a sort of subdivision like Fox Faith figure into how well you're able to sell what you're willing, what you want to do, as opposed to, you know, just kind of going in with a general pitch?
Well, you know, with the interesting thing with Fox Faith and with Mama Wanna Sing is that once they did the research on the play, it wasn't that, because I didn't go in with a script or with any cast. I went in on the strength of the history of the play. You know, Mama Wanna Sing is what started the whole genre, the live play touring. So once they did the research and did the history and found out that Mama Wanna Sing has toured in 22 countries, you know, it's grossed, you know, close to $50 to $60 million when it was out on tour, it was pretty much a no-brainer. So it wasn't, I didn't really have to do a hard pitch on it once they actually did the research on the play.
All right. Well, we are talking about black film, specifically Power Players, how you actually get what you need to get done and up on the screen. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I am Farai Chidea. We're just hearing from Jeff Clanagan, the CEO of Code Black Entertainment. Also speaking with D'Angela Proctor-Steed, the co-founder of Momentum Entertainment, and Rob Hardy, a founder of Rainforest Films. So, Rob, let me go back to you. You, in your press kit, reference Oscar Michaud. And many different people, and D'Angela, you seem to be a fan as well of Oscar Michaud. What is his legacy to you, and how do you see yourself carrying it on?
You know, Oscar Michaud was a pioneering filmmaker in the early 1900s, and what he would do is finance and distribute African-American-themed films geared towards our audience at a time, especially then, when there weren't any. So he broke a lot of new stars, had a lot of new stories, and showed them in a lot of different places. And we basically took a page from him because as we were starting out and doing primarily production and distribution, we saw ourselves as him, as going to a lot of underserved markets, markets that don't necessarily always get bigger name talent and things of that nature, whether it's a Flint, Michigan or a Jacksonville, Florida. And then we would go to these markets and show our films and bring our stars and make it an event. And that's kind of, you know, how we started our distribution process. And it really worked well for us. And even though more recently we have been doing studio finance and distributed films, we still implore a lot of those same marketing lessons that we learned from our days of distribution.
What about working with a partner? And I just want to get a little bit from you, Rob. You work with Will Packer, D'Angela, you work with Nia Hill. What is it like for each of you, and Rob, you can go first, to try to make something happen in partnership with someone else?
Having a partner is great because you have two like-minded individuals that have a singular vision. And we each have different strengths. I primarily lean more towards the creative side. I'm a director and a writer and sometime producer. And my partner, Will, produces exclusively. And so it's great because we're able to have two different perspectives when we approach a project. And we're also able to operate in different aspects of entertainment. So there may be some times when I may direct for network television or he may take a job as a producer for hire, but we all still do that under the guise of Rainforest. So I think that it enables us to stay fresh and to have different perspectives and to balance each other out.
What about you?
I think the same goes for Nia and myself. We are completely different people. We're completely different individuals, and we have completely different tastes. But what it boils down to is we have a common ground of quality and wanting to uplift our people. So it's an interesting dynamic. People come into our office and they're always like, you guys are the reality show, really. We are so completely different. I'm more commercial. She's more artsy, more artistic.
You're an attorney.
I'm an attorney. I'm stuck in the analytical side of my brain. And she's a very extremely one of the most creative people that I know on this planet. So a marketing genius, director, writer, and I don't go in that lane. I'm on this side.
Jeff, you work largely on your own in terms of shaping these projects. What are the advantages and disadvantages of going it solo?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I have a pretty big team. So I have a team that is able to execute my vision. So where I have, you know, I'm on the creative side, but I'm also on the business side, and I have people on my team that can support and execute my analytical side and my creative side.
I guess for all of you, one thing that comes to mind is that if you think of a place like FAMU, there are a lot of people there who would love to be in your shoes, Rob. There are a lot of people at so many, you know, in neighborhoods, colleges, living rooms who would want to be in your place. Just quickly, what is one thing that you did to make sure that you were able to achieve your dreams, Rob?
For me, it was creating an opportunity where there wasn't one. One thing Florida A&M did not and still does not have a film program, but you had a lot of people there that were interested in entertainment. And at the time that I was a student there, Common was a student there, and the guys from Dead Prez were students there. And you just had so many different people that had these aspirations. And we considered it an environment where everybody had a, as I call it, a hustle. So it was a matter of how do you find a way to turn your hustle into something that makes money. So for us, our first project, Chocolate City, was a way to get all the people together that had a passion for something, entertainment, and we put it together and make a project. And we saw Master P do that in New Orleans and create an industry down there where there wasn't one. So I think that no matter where you come from, you have the ability to do the same thing.
All right, we're going to have to keep it tight. D'Angela.
Same question?
Yep.
Well, I went to Spelman for undergraduate school, and every week we had to go to chapel, and there was a different woman there every week telling us we can do anything, be anyone, we can, you know, just accomplish anything. And I would say just never quit and always be willing to make sacrifices for your dreams, for sure, because no one's going to hand it to you.
And Rob? Rob, what would you say has helped you?
You know, really just the ability to have faith in myself and to have faith in God to say, what is my dream and what do I really want to do and what would I do for free? And then just letting people know what my dream is and being willing to work with other people.
All right. Well, lady, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Rob Hardy, co-founder of Rainforest Films, a film production and distribution company based in Atlanta. He joined us from Doppler Studios. D'Angela Proctor Steed, the co-founder of Momentum Entertainment, a film distribution company that owns Strange Fruit Films. She joined me here at NPR West in Culver City, California. And Jeff Clanagan, CEO of Code Black Entertainment. He joined us by phone. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time again for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. And Tony, baseball is back on Capitol Hill.
That's right, Farai. Mr. Clemens goes to Washington, and Mr. McNamee goes too. Steroids, human growth hormones, and a House committee investigation into baseball, that is the main focus of today's conversation with New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
The great Tony Cox. Everything is great, man.
Listen, well, maybe not for Roger Clemens. Baseball's most celebrated pitcher appeared before Congress yesterday after he was named in a federal report on steroid use in baseball. Now, if you've never heard one of his many vehement denials that he ever took steroids, here's what he told lawmakers yesterday under oath.
No matter what we discuss here today, I'm never going to have my name restored. But I've got to try and set the record straight. I'm not saying Senator Mitchell's report is entirely wrong. I am saying Brian McNamee's statements about me are wrong. Let me be clear. I have never taken steroids or HGH.
Now, Bill, that was followed by the also under oath testimony of Clemens' accuser, Brian McNamee, who said again that he injected the future Hall of Fame pitcher with steroids on several occasions. What was new yesterday was the affidavit from Clemens' former teammate and best buddy, Andy Pettit. Pettit claimed that Clemens told him that he had indeed used human growth hormone and that Mrs. Clemens did too, and so on it went. One thing's for sure, Bill Roden, somebody is lying.
And Tony, not just lying. I mean, this goes beyond lies. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say I took, you know, I thought it was flaxseed oil, you know. But it's one other thing for somebody who's an eyewitness to say I injected him 16 to 21 times and then said, you know what, it was really more than that. I mean, injecting you. And then you say you're lying. I mean, that to me, that there should be no question that this is a Justice Department investigation. This has to, somebody's got to be indicted. This has to go beyond before the grand jury. If this does not, if Clemens does not get the same treatment that Barry Bonds was exposed to over a period of 2 years, then it's a complete travesty. It's a travesty of justice.
Now, there's no smoking gun, though. So is there going to be enough evidence one way or the other to know whether Clemens perjured himself or if McNamee did?
Tony, we may not have smoking guns, but we got a box full of syringes that this guy saved.
Barry Bonds still wants to play next season. It's not clear if Clemens does or not. But would a team take the rocket now that this scandal has grown even bigger, do you think?
I think that teams will be hard-pressed to do it, but my sense, Tony, is still that there's still not the same vitriol aimed at Clemens that there is as Bonds. I think that Clemens will have an easier time of pitching than Bonds will have of hitting. With Bonds, you had him, what the government says, making untrue statements before a grand jury. Here, you've got an eyewitness account, a guy who said, I injected him. You've got sworn affidavits from his teammate. You've got Chuck Knobloch, who corroborated what McNamee said. You got everything pointed at this guy, and you got Clemens saying, you're all lying. You're all lying. So if nothing else, the government has to say, okay, you know what, enough of this. Let's see if the grand jury feels that there's enough evidence.
Well, along that same point, because you mentioned the government, we have Congress looking into sports on three fronts, Bill, right now. We have steroids in baseball. We have Spygate in football. And just to remind you, that's the case of the Patriots videotaping the other team's signals and maybe practices and the destroying of the tape. Lawmakers are also looking into the health problems of former NFL players. What do you make of all this Washington involvement in sports?
Well, you know, Tony, the problem is sports, the government sort of allowed sports like a child to kind of grow up, you know, pampered, unsupervised, on their own, no discipline, nothing. So this now the sports grows up to be this 21-year-old kid that has no discipline, no regard for authority, and is kind of grown up wild. And I think that what you're seeing now is Congress saying, you know what, we got to rein this stuff in because this has really gotten out of control. I don't ever think there'll be a Department of Sports created, but clearly sports has grown to this multi-billion-dollar industry that's kind of gone on its own devices and really needs to be reined back in.
Clemens' treatment before the committee raised a lot of eyebrows, in part because he had already gone to meet individually with a number of members of the committee, and the questioning seemed to be a love fest, and it also seemed to be partisan. What did you make of the behavior of the committee members during the quote-unquote interrogation?
Yeah, Tony, it was clearly partisan. You know, the Democrats were throwing fastballs at Clemens and sort of softballs at McNamee, and the Republicans were routinely decking McNamee. I mean, they were brushing him back, knocking him down. And that's what troubles me about this, is that I just look at this and think that there are some forces within Congress who want to see Clemens walk.
Bill Roden, it's always good to talk to you.
Hey, Tony, it's always a pleasure.
All right.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with Bill Roden. Bill is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. There are a lot of myths about the sexual lives of married couples. One is that the woman is the most likely to claim the headache when it's time to go to bed. Well, turns out that many husbands are shutting down and turning off when it comes to their sex lives. It's all in a new book called He's Just Not Up For It Anymore, Why Men Stop Having Sex and What You Can Do About It. The authors are Bob Berkowitz and Susan Yeager Berkowitz. They're married to each other, and they're with me now. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let me ask you this, Bob. You guys wrote another book together called What Men Won't Tell You But Women Need to Know. So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, you know, there are 40 million Americans who are in sexless marriages. And you touched on it in your introduction. There is this, you know, wrongheaded idea that if there's a sexless marriage, it must be the woman. And we kept hearing over and over and over again that men are also shutting down. What we found out from some of the top experts in the country is that half the time, indeed, it is the husband who stops being interested in making love.
I'm going to ask you another question before I turn to Susan. Now, you did this survey where you got 4,000 responses, mm-hmm. but you say, and you're a journalist, I'm quoting you, our approach was journalistic rather than scientific. Right. Why do such a big survey then?
Well, you know, we had to find a self-identified population. These were folks who said, yes, we are in sexless marriages where the husband is the one who shut down physically. And we couldn't just go to the whole world and find out pinpoint people who are in this relationship. We wanted to do in-depth research on these people who said, this is our issue.
But I think we also might add to that, we didn't necessarily expect to get more than 4,000 respondents to our survey. We put the survey out there, and the responses started pouring in.
It was like a waterfall of responses. People were dying to get this off their chest. Women were embarrassed, ashamed, and they felt that their self-esteem was in the gutter. And men never talk about this, not to their wives, not to their best friends, to no one.
Susan, what were some of the things that you found both on the men's side and the women's side?
Well, the men, the first thing I want to say is that on the women's side, the main reason they gave when we said, why do you think your partner, your husband has shut down? The main thing they said, almost 70%, was, I don't know why. On the other hand, on the man's side, the guys did know why, and they gave us reasons. Clearly, they're not speaking to one another. The men said things like, I'm angry, a lot of anger, I'm depressed, I'm bored. The number one reason the guys gave, she's not sexually adventurous enough. A lot of them said she's gained a lot of weight. So they had very specific reasons, and a lot of them, however, seemed to be pointing the finger in the direction away from themselves.
Let me ask you about that one specific thing. 68% said, I've stopped having sex with my wife because she isn't sexually adventurous enough.
Yes.
First of all, do you buy that that's true? And secondly, what does adventurous mean, and how can couples even figure out what it means to a man and a woman?
For one guy, he told us, he says, look, I'd just be happy if we turned the lights on while we made love. But we suspect that most of these men are saying she is no longer showing any passion, any interest, any positive reinforcement for our lovemaking. Not to say that they're bringing much to the bed either. And it spills over into anger and recriminations. And what these men do is that they shut down physically, emotionally, and verbally.
Susan, what's the process if you're a woman and you talk to specifically heterosexual couples in long-term relationships, either married or not married, but if you're a woman and your life partner, the man in your life, just shuts down, how do you even start asking the right questions or going about asking things in a way that actually produces some change, as opposed to just, you know, what the heck is going on, you idiot, you know?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is treat it as a we problem. Sit down with your partner and say, sweetie, I miss that part of our lives. It's very important to me. It was a wonderful part of my life, and I'm sorry it's gone. And we have to find out a way to solve the problem. The first place to start would be really on the physical side. There are a number of reasons, physical reasons, why a guy may be shutting down. Find out what's going on. Is he taking medication for depression, for diabetes, for hypertension? Any of these medicines may have libido-lowering side effects.
What about intimacy? Where does emotional intimacy come into play? I want to ask both of you that. Susan, why don't you kick it off?
There are a number of issues to be addressed when it comes to intimacy, and one of the main ones is there are men who are afraid of it. They may be able to make a commitment to a woman and marry her, and then suddenly be terrified and withhold sex because they're so afraid of intimacy, of being intimate with this woman that they love. The fear of losing her is so tremendous that they're afraid to go that extra step. One of the things that surprised us a lot was how many women said the sex stopped on the honeymoon or within the first year of marriage. And intimacy often is the reason for that.
You know, it's almost as if some of these men are saying, I'm going to leave you before you leave me, because they're so afraid of being left. Their fears of abandonment are big time. And so one of the ways that they demonstrate their independence or their you know, fear of being left is that they withdraw sexually, intimately, emotionally. They just pull back a bit.
All right, my final question. I know you guys have been married for a decade, and the obvious question is, have you guys ever had to deal with, I'm just not up for it anymore?
Well, look, once in a while, every couple's had that issue. You know, nobody's consistent. We just, as you said, we just had our 10th wedding anniversary last July, and things are working out pretty well for us.
Well, congratulations. Thanks, Bob, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Bob Berkowitz and Susan Yeager Berkowitz are the authors of He's Just Not Up For It Anymore, Why Men Stop Having Sex and What You Can Do About It. And now it's time for your letters. Joining me now to sort through the mail is our producer and editor, Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher, what have we got today?
Well, we got a couple letters about our guest, Boyce Watkins. The Syracuse University finance professor talked about the new economic stimulus package. Boyce explained how the plan will impact the working poor.
I don't think they're going to benefit that much in the long term, in the areas that really matter. Basically, the stimulus package is designed to do one thing, to get money in the hands of poor and middle-class people so that they will spend it and throw it right back into the economy. And we're saying, rather than taking that money and spending it as they want you to, save it or invest it or do something different with your money.
Well, Robert Gable in Berkeley, California heard the interview with Boyce, and he sent us this. You generally have very good commentators. However, Boyce Watkins throws in gratuitous racial references. For example, he talked about rich white folks telling poor people about the recession. Rich black folks would have probably been just as tardy in noticing the recession.
And earlier this week, I spoke with Nancy Amanda Redd. The former Miss Virginia has a new book called Body Drama. It's aimed at teenage girls working through body image issues. Janine Brewer in Myersville, Maryland, heard our talk and she wrote us this. If Nancy Amanda Redd was truly on a mission to help women and girls with body image difficulties, she should put some of her effort towards ending the so-called beauty contest that she took part in.
Also, we screwed up our story last week about black stereotypes in film. Listener Kamasi Hill in Chicago caught our goof. Kamasi writes, it was stated that Michael Clark Duncan won an Oscar 60 years after Hattie McDaniel. The truth is, he was nominated, but he never won. Now, for Rye, according to the Oscar Awards Online database, Kamasi is right. In 2000, Michael Clark Duncan was nominated for Best Actor in a Supporting Role for his performance in The Green Mile. But Michael Caine won the award for his role as Dr. Wilbur Larch in The Cider House Rules.
Well, our apologies and thanks for catching it. And finally, earlier this week, I spoke with independent reporter Bob Butler. He has done a series of reports about how climate change is affecting the West African nation of Senegal. Listener Michelle Higgins wrote in about my talk with Bob and NPR's ongoing coverage of climate change. Michelle says, in a report on global warming in Senegal, Farai wondered if people cared if they were plugging in. I wanted her to know that at that very moment, I had my map pulled out. I was marking the events being discussed as notes near Senegal on the map. Yes, we do care. And this series helps us learn more and become more connected. Keep it up.
That's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. And as always, thanks, Christopher.
You're welcome, Farai.